We saw in chapter 17 and 18 that one man's idolatry led into a national apostasy. Here, what we find is an unrelated event of one man's experience now shows a national civil crisis. This is the reading of God's Word, Judges chapter 19. Now it came about in those days, when there was no king in Israel, that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Yehuda. But his concubine played the harlot against him, and she went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem in Yehuda. And it was there for a period for 4 months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak tenderly to her in order to bring her back, taking with him a servant and a pair of donkeys. So she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he was glad to meet him. His father-in-law, the girl's father, detained him, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. Now on the fourth day, they got up early in the morning, and he prepared to go. And the girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Sustain yourself with a piece of bread, and afterward you may go." So both of them sat down and ate and drank together. And the girl's father said to the man, "Please be willing to spend the night and let your heart be merry." Then the man arose to go, but his father-in-law urged him so that he spent the night there again. On the fifth day, he arose to go early in the morning, and the girl's father said, "Please sustain yourself and wait until afternoon." So both of them ate. Then the man arose to go along with his concubine and servant, his father-in-law. The girl's father said to him, "Behold now, the day has drawn to a close. Please spend the night. Lo, the day is coming to an end. Spend the night here, that your heart be merry. Then tomorrow you may arise early for your journey so that you may go home." But the man was not willing to spend the night. So he arose and departed and came to a place opposite Yebus, that is Jerusalem. And there was with him a pair of saddle donkeys. His concubine was also with him. When they were near Yebus, the day was almost gone. And the servant said to his master, "Please come. And let us turn aside into this city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it." However, his master said to him, "We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who are not of the sons of Israel, but we will go out as far as Gibeah." He said to his servant, "Come and let us approach one of these places and we will spend the night in Gibeah or Ramah." So they passed along and went their way, and the sun set on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Binyamin. They turned aside there in order to enter and lodge at Gibeah. When they entered, they sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night. Then behold, an old man was coming out of the field from his work at that evening. Now the man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was staying at Gibeah, but the men of the place were Benjaminites. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, "Where are you going, and where do you come from?" He said to him, "We are passing from Bethlehem in Yehuda to the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, for I am from there, and I went to Bethlehem in Yehuda, but I am now going to my house, and no man will take me into his house. Yet there is both straw and fodder for our donkeys, and also bread and wine for me, your maidservant, and the young man who is with your servants. There is no lack of anything." The old man said, "Peace to you. Only let me take care of all your needs. However, do not spend the night in the open square." So he took him into his house and gave the donkey fodder, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. While they were celebrating, behold, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows, surrounded the house, pounding the door, and they spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, "Bring out the man who came into your house, that we may have relations with him." Then the man, the owner of the house, went out to them and said to them, "No, my fellows, please do not act so wickedly, since this man has come into my house, and do not commit this act of folly. Here's my virgin daughter and his concubine. Please let me bring them out, that you may ravish them, and do not do to them whatever you wish. And do to them whatever you wish, but do not commit such an act of folly against this man." But the men would not listen to him, so the man seized his concubine and brought her out to them. And they raped her and abused her all night until morning, then let her go at the approach of dawn. As the day began to dawn, the woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house where her master was until full daylight. When her master arose in the morning and opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, then behold, his concubine was lying at the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, "Get up and let us go." But there was no answer. And he placed her on the donkey, and the man arose and went to his home. When he entered his house, he took a knife and laid hold of his concubine, cut her in 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout the territory of Israel. All who saw it said, "Nothing like this has ever happened or been seen from the day when the sons of Israel came up from the land of Egypt to this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak up." Please be seated. This has got to be one of the darkest and the most gruesome stories, even eclipsing the story that we are very familiar with in Genesis chapter 19, the event that Sodom, as God sent his angels to find out what's happening in Sodom and Gomorrah, and that he ultimately judged the two pagan cities there. There are marks of canonization of Israel, whereas the previous section was about the canonization of Israel's religion. This is now the canonization of Israel's morality. So what we have here is a debauchery, a further deterioration of the moral condition of Israel, so much so that there was no distinction between Canaan and Israel. And when the society becomes this corrupt, when the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? When there is no justice, when there's no love for the neighbor, when there's no hospitality, what can the righteous do? As a matter of fact, suffering is necessarily that which comes to the weakest member of society. And what we have here are callous treatment of this woman. Now, we have internal evidence to believe that she's probably not the most pristine of women. But that's not the issue. The issue is, how can Israelites allow a fellow Israelite to be treated in such a way? And so, just like in the previous narrative where Micah, one man's theft, idolatry, and perversion of Israel's worship had precipitated to a national apostasy of the downgrade of the tribe of Dan, and setting up a permanent station that conflicted with Yahweh worship throughout the history of Israel. Here is one event of a Levite. And how did it happen? I mean, this narrative is so long. Three chapters, you know. By the time you get to the end, we almost forget what the whole deal was. Why is the nation going to war? Why is an entire tribe of Benjamin almost about to be wiped out and become extinct? And why are there 200 women being set aside at Shiloh? What's all this about? By the time we get to that point, we would already forget what precipitated the whole thing. And in a time where every man is doing what is right in his own eyes, it took one concubine and her action to trigger an entire set of events that almost brought a nation on its knees. What's surprising about this entire chapter is the name God, even the generic version, doesn't even appear. Yahweh is nowhere to be found in this chapter. And it's the second longest narrative in the book of Judges, and it certainly has the most complex plot. The plot thickens as the story develops, like the previous story. You just don't get it until you see the end, but it thickens as things move on. The climax is in the final chapter, chapter 21, where an entire tribe, the tribe of Benjamin, tribe of fierce warriors, is about to be wiped out. One woman's angry departure causes civil war, an almost complete extinction of a tribe in Israel. Could that be possible? And in a time where every man is doing what is right in his own eyes, it is not only possible, but it actually happened in Israel. This story perhaps is darkest portrayal of what's happening in Israel. But it starts, surprisingly enough, innocent enough, in a family. It starts with a quarrel between a man and his concubine. Why a concubine? Where is his wife? She's nowhere to be found. Perhaps she's dead. Perhaps she's living, but he is in Ephraim, removed. Perhaps he's there near Shiloh, maybe doing his Levitical service. And we have a picture of an older Levite and a younger concubine. And due to her age and immaturity, she's continually described in verse 3, 4, 6, 8, 9 as Na'ara, a girl, translated in English here. So what we have is a typical inter-family relationship that's gone awry because of an older man and a young girl who decides that she's going to go back to her father's house. And he goes after her to fetch her, and having experienced lavish hospitality and becoming impatient, decides to take his concubine and leave in mid-afternoon, only to find himself in the nearest city, which is the city of Jebus, by Jebusites, which were non-Semitic people, and who still occupied Jerusalem, which was not captured by the Jews until King David's day. David made that his headquarters. And so it was still a pagan city, and he didn't want to stay there. He thought that his chances would be much better if he traveled another 6 miles to Gibeah and Ramah, near the territories of his own countrymen, Benjamin. Well, he was wrong. He thought he had arrived in Israel, but he has actually arrived in Sodom. And in the mind of the narrator, there's no doubt that he had Genesis chapter 19. Because in Hebrew, there's identical number of words. 69 words here to describe this narrative, 69 words there in Genesis 19. Almost 25% of the words are identical in both Genesis 19 and Judges 19 here. And the themes, there's over 24 thematic similarities between the two. So there was no doubt that he had Genesis 19 in mind. The fact that Sodom was a Canaanite pagan city during the days of Abraham shows that this was the typical condition of Canaan. Another surprising detail about this entire chapter is that none of the characters are named by name. At least the previous Levite at the end of chapter 18 is identified as Yonatan, Ben Gershom, Ben Moshe, a son of Gershom, son of Moses. Here, this Levite is not known by name. Neither is the concubine, neither is the father-in-law, neither is the Ephraimite old man who shows him hospitality, who himself is a stranger, resident living in the tribe of Benjamin. Which means that the narrator has chosen this literary method to show that this is not a specific issue, this is a general condition that's happening all over the place. This is the kind of poor hospitality, lack of brotherly love, that precipitated this kind of chaotic situation, horrible situation. And instead of driving out these parasitic Canaanite people, Israelites have become like them. And that's why, even though this happened chronologically early on in Israel's history, it's thematically placed here at the very end for thematic and theological purposes to show the further deterioration of Israel when every man was doing what is right in his own eyes, when there's no king in Israel, when Israel rejected Yahweh as their king. This is what's happening. Such were the times. Everybody here is just heartless, it seems. A Levite is represented by every Levite, uncaring and heartless. A concubine, every woman, capable of being victim of rape and brutality if you just happen to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. Citizens of Gibeah, rotten, inhospitable, and even unwilling to protect those who are passerbyers. left to fend for themselves. Such were the times. Now, the timing of the event should be placed early in the period of Judges, as I mentioned before, because Aaron's grandson, Phinehas, is set to be serving as the high priest. In Judges chapter 20, verse 28, if you notice, there's a national convocation, and they seek the Lord's will. And the high priest, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, Aaron's son, stood before it to minister. There you have it. Now, if you calculate the times, this means that it's only a few years after Yehoshua died. Less than one generation after Yehoshua died, we find such atrocity already occurring in Gibeah. And the reason why we do believe that this is early on as well, because of Phinehas, his ministering. Phinehas is Aaron's grandson. It's only a couple generations. You know, Eleazar was the high priest when Joshua was leading the people into Canaan. And here is Phinehas serving after his father had died. And so this is less than a generation later. And putting that chronological marker here and figuring all this out, we find that this is very surprising. In such a short time, can Israel go into such debauchery, such atrocious behavior, and such canonization rapidly? That's exactly what the narrator is trying to highlight. And to continue to support this early chronology of this event, we find that the entire nation was able to rally. You know, later on, when Samson was judging Israel, the Philistines were dominating Palestine. Therefore, they could not rally like this. There's no Philistine to be mentioned at all in this context. And yet all the 12 tribes gathered together, or 11 of the 12 tribes, to judge Benjamin, to crush Benjamin for its heinous behavior. Because he would not police itself. Whatever conscience that was left in the hearts of the 11 tribes were stirred to anger as they received a parcel, a postal of a member of a woman. Please forgive me for the gruesome details, but I think you and I sometimes need to read this. It's in the Bible. There's a reason why it's depicted in gory details. Limb for limb. There's a reason for that. Because such outrageous acts of brutality and shock is used by the Levite to get the attention of the rest of the tribes and saying, you have to do something about this. When a head arrives, the tribe of Judah. Two hands arrive at Manasseh and Ephraim. 2 feet arrive at other tribes. Zebulun, Issachar. Arms, legs, torso. Could you imagine the gory details? And with the message that goes along with that. This is what happened. This is the outrage. What are you going to do about it? That's how this chapter ends. And so there are 5 breaks within this chapter. And it sets the tone for what comes in chapter 20 and chapter 21. First, the setting. Verses 1 to 3. Here's the formulaic introduction, verse 1. Now, it came about in those days when there was no king in Israel, when Israel refused to acknowledge Yahweh, then the full democratization of sin settled in. They didn't need any leader to lead them to depravity. They were doing just fine. You know, people don't need leaders to sin. And many sinful leaders have led the nation into sin, greater sin. But you leave them alone, they sin just fine. And it shows the signs of the times. There was a certain Levite staying in the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim. We're surprised to find out another Levite enters the narrative in the same familiar terrain, hill country of Ephraim. But unlike the previous Levite whose identity was revealed, this one is hidden, anonymous. The narrator refuses to identify any one of these. It is as if all the nation, I mean, all the tribes of the nation of Israel knows about this. This is what precipitated a national civil war. This Levite is described as a man staying in the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim. Is he at Shiloh, ministering before the tabernacle? We don't know, but he doesn't seem like he's a Levite for hire, like the young Levite that we saw in the previous chapter. What we do know about this man is that he took a concubine for himself, and that's an ominous sign because concubines are usually contractually taken with a hefty sum, just like a wife, a dowry, but a concubine has not the full status of a wife. A full status of a wife legally is that the wife, any child that the wife produces, now becomes a legal heir. And so the father is obligated to leave inheritance money to the wife and to the legal heir, whether it be sons and whatnot. Here, this concubine is taken purely for sexual reasons. So it would be equivalent to our today's live-in girlfriend. Not contractually married, but living together. So he took him for himself from Bethlehem in Yehuda. There's that city again. Little town. Town of David's birth. And if this was written after David, then these kinds of details won't appear, because that would be an embarrassment to King David, the greatest king in Israel. It shows it's pre-monarchical period, before David. The Levite is a spiritual leader among his people. What's he doing, having a live-in girlfriend? This man's marital status is questionable. His moral life is questionable. We have an ominous picture already in the introduction of verse 1. The careful reader would pick this up. Verse 2, but his concubine played the harlot against him. Now, this phrasing doesn't quite fit the context well. And there's a textual variant reading from the Septuagint, that is the Greek translation of the Hebrew. And that same word for play the harlot, which is zana here, if it's translated zanach, and it looks almost identical to a non-Hebrew reader, it's the difference between a H and a H, which is a guttural, a chet. And look, the spelling is identical almost, but it's slightly different. So it could easily be mistaken. And if you read it with the zanach, then it would read, and his concubine was angry against him. So it's the difference between playing the harlot or being angry. So we need to look at this from two different vantage points. If the original text, which is the Hebrew that's carried here in many translations, although some carry the variant reading from the Septuagint, if it is playing the harlot, it's immorality, then it could be while her older husband, the Levite, was busy working, out to work, if you will, she, the younger concubine, was unfaithful. And realizing her unfaithfulness and didn't want the consequence that's tied in with it, she decides to take off back to her home, back to her father. That's the context of here. Now, if it's the zanach with the chet ending, then it would be that she became angry. There is marital discord, and she decided, well, I'm off. I can't live with this old man. I'm going. Whichever the reason is, it shows that she left and he went looking for her. That's the context. Now, she's gone for a period of 4 months, which tells you that either the Levite was gone for a while or he waited for her to come back. She didn't come back, so he went out looking for her. Verse 3, and her husband arose. Now, notice how the phrasing is. These little details are very subtly, very intellectually, very intelligently inserted into the text so that a careful reader would catch that. Because here, in the beginning, it says, her husband arose and went after her. Now let's skip all the way to the end of the chapter, and I want you to take a look at this phrasing. Look at verse 27. Verse 26. As the day began to dawn, the woman came. Now notice it's the woman, right? Not the young girl. The woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house where her master was. Very interesting, isn't it? Now the language of master and servant is used. No longer the girl is used, but a woman. That kind of subtle change of vocabulary tells you something massively has changed. Something has gone on. This woman has been violated. She has not been fully treated like a human being. She's been treated like a servant, chattel, if you will. She's demeaned, brought low. That's the kind of masterful use of vocabulary, and there's masterful use of dialogue. And so this narration is done so that the full impact of the grossness, the callousness, would be highlighted. That we would continue to be shocked. So how can these mundane, seemingly unrelated events precipitate into not only a horrible personal family tragedy, but a national crisis and civil war? And where's the Lord in all this? And that's why this is at the very end. If you want to know how bad Israel got and the full canonization of Israel, then you take a look here. And what precipitated it? Like this. Family dispute. A man's poor decision in choosing not to marry but have a concubine. A Levite, a spiritual leader, and his immoral disposition. And then he packs. Her husband arose and went after her to speak tenderly to her. His initial motivation was to woo her back. He wants her. Taking with him his servant, he's a man of means. This Levite's not poor, not like the other young guy who has no savings. He wants a job. This man has means. He has a servant and a pair of donkeys, showing that he's going to take plenty of provision for himself, for his servant, for his concubine. And so he packs well. And then he finally arrives, and the next phrase tells us that she gladly receives him, brought him into her father's house. And when the girl's father saw him, he was glad to meet him. Now initially, everything that's said about everybody here so far is all positive. There's nothing here that we can say, oh, there's something fishy going on here. What is it? Everything about it is all positive. This concubine is continually referred to as a girl. And the setting looks pretty good. What could go wrong? And it catches the reader by surprise. Now, it goes from the ordinary to comical. You've seen the setting. Now, let's look at the situation. The situation. What's highlighted here in this situation is hospitality, verses 4 to 9. The father-in-law, he just kind of is super hospitable. And he just wants to hold on and as long as possible to the son-in-law, it seems. He just lavishes his son-in-law. He really loves his son-in-law. He's glad to see him. Throws a big party for him. They're merry. Everything looks good. But something's missing here. What's going on? He wants to take her back. And it's clear that he wants to take her back. But her father-in-law wants to make sure that he doesn't come back, it seems. By overshowering him with a level of hospitality. Saying, please stay, please stay, please stay. So let's take a look at the situation of the hospitality. Verse 4, his father-in-law, his girl's father, detained him. Now notice that word, detained him. Why? You see, because Getting a concubine is more of a business transaction, and this is pretty crass and crude. It's more of a business transaction than a really a relationship building. This man has no real love for his father-in-law. She's bought and paid for, if you will. But in the ancient Near Eastern custom, if the woman leaves, then the father-in-law is obligated to return every dime of the dowry price. The man doesn't want to do that. He's got a lot to lose. He probably spent it all. All that money he got from the Levite, who is well-to-do. He's got a servant, a couple of donkeys. You know, it's like a couple of pickup trucks. And so it seems that the father-in-law wants to protect his assets and make sure that he patches things up in this marital relationship so that the marriage or this relationship between the Levite and his daughter would go well and not go sour. And that's what we find it looks like the man doing. And what we find the man doing is quite admirable. He's showing good, jolly hospitality. But it's to a point, it just becomes comical. After 3 days, the man wants to leave, she let him leave. But he detains him and he detains him and detains him. What's going on here? Well, it's set in that kind of a context in the situation of hospitality so that the reader will see and understand what will happen next. It is the complete absence of hospitality. Over-hospitable on one hand here, zero hospitality on the other hand there, as to bring forth that kind of a contrast. Something else is going on here that if you're careful that you would find, the woman is nowhere to be found. She's nowhere to be found here. In all the partying and all the eating and all the drinking and marrying, merrymaking is between the father-in-law and the son. And that's why he becomes very exasperated. He wants to leave. Because the father-in-law is doing everything that he can to get the son-in-law to take his concubine and leave, right, in a way that there will be no room for any further precipitation of bad relationship, because if this woman ever came back, he would have to pay the full price. Doesn't want that. He's trying to prevent all these things from happening. And so a careful reader and understanding the ancient Near Eastern protocols of a relationship like this would zoom out and see, wow, the way this man treats his daughter and the way the Levite later on treats the concubine is just not very good for the woman. There's no respect. She's just a piece of property to be jostled here and there. So on the fourth day, they got up early in the morning and prepared to go. The girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Sustain yourself with a piece of bread, and afterward you can go." Okay, he's engineering again. Verse 6, so both of them sat down and ate and drank together, like a good son-in-law would. That way it would be very inappropriate for him to rebuff such kindness. He would have to take it at face value and say thank you and to his father-in-law. So both of them sat down and ate and drank together, and the girl's father said to the man, "Please be willing to spend the night and let your heart be merry." It could be that he's trying to patch things up, to schmooze him a little bit, make sure that he himself takes full responsibility for the woman. And the man arose to go, but his father-in-law urged him so that he spent the night there again. And the fifth day he rose to go early in the morning, and the girl's father said, "Please sustain yourself and wait until afternoon." He's up to his old tricks again, and by this time the Levite is getting very exasperated. So both of them ate, and when the man arose to go along with his concubine and servant, his father-in-law, the girl's father said to him, "Behold, now the day has drawn to a close. Please spend the night." Now here, in chapter 19, the timing is very important. He should have left early, but he stayed until the afternoon. He should have stayed overnight and bore with his boring father-in-law another evening and to leave early in the morning. But because he left at the time that he did, He only had two choices, a Canaanite city of the Jebusites named Jerusalem, and a very cold Benjaminite city, a name of Gibeah. So the antics of the father-in-law is just over-the-top hospitality. It's just comical. But we all know something's going on here. All the hospitality is shown to the Levite. You get a sense this is a man's world. Later on, you see the old man offering his virgin daughter plus the concubine to an evil mob. It's a man's world. In other words, in a male-dominated society, in a male-centric society, the worst possible moral decline hurts the weakest members of society, the women. And that's a picture of Canaan. Women are just second class. They're just chattel. They're just pieces of, please forgive me, meat for men. And that's the kind of brutal picture that we get here. And it begins early. And in a very sophisticated and subtle way, the narrator shows a little bit at a time of the interaction between men. Women are marginalized, just nowhere to be found, totally unnamed, and mistreated at the end. And even after she dies, she doesn't get a decent burial. But she's hacked into 12 pieces to send a message. That's the kind of society that the narrator is trying to describe. So it's the father-in-law who doesn't want to give up his bride price or the dowry price since the daughter had left. Now if the man kicked out the woman, then the father-in-law is absolved from all responsibility. Right? But that's not how it happened. And so we look at the situation and it is very bleak. That's the situation. As funny and comical as this hospitality scene is, the absence of certain elements surprise us and it really disturbs us a little bit. Now let's take a look at the development of the next part of the narration, the shutout. We've seen the setting, the situation, and now the shutout, verses 10 to 21. The timing of these events, again, occur at the worst possible time. Verse 10, but the man was not willing to spend the night. This is the first time the man actually exerts his will here. He arose and departed and came to a place opposite Jebus, that is, Jerusalem. From this point on, the father-in-law doesn't appear at all. And so the narrator masterfully wove him in their interaction through dialogue. He does all the talking. And his son-in-law simply responds to show that there is an over-the-top hospitality. Even if you look at it positively, he was being very hospitable, but more so to cover his end. And then he no longer appears. He was simply an accessory for the narration so that other things would be developed. What would be developed? That this Levite made a wrong decision at the wrong time and ended up in the wrong place and faced a horrible outcome. So let's follow along and see what's happening. And they were with him, a pair of saddle donkeys, his concubine also with him. Verse 11. When they were near Jebus, the day was almost gone. Verse 11. And the servant said to his master, please come. And let us turn aside into the city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it. In hindsight, that was probably a good counsel, wise counsel. Hey, this is the day when every man's doing what is right in his own eyes. Israelites and the Canaanites living happily side by side. No big deal. Here's a city. It's getting late. Let's stay here. Verse 12, however, his master said to him, we will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who are not of the sons of Israel, but we will go on as far as Gibeah. That dialogue is very important because now the Levite overrides the suggestion of his servants and his prejudice comes out clearly. We're not going to stay here with the foreigners. We're not going to take our chances with these people. We're going to go and take our chances with the fellow Israelite. And he knows the next major destination city is in Benjamin, Ramah or Gilead here. Gibeah, sorry. Verse 13, he said to his servant, "Come, let us approach one of these places and we will spend the night at Gibeah or Ramah." So they travel additional 6 miles from there. In verse 14, they arrive expecting the typical Oriental custom of hospitality. I mean, they were lavish with hospitality back at the father-in-law's house. Verse 14, so they passed along, went on their way, and the sun set on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. But the Levite was saddened to find out that none of the residents show hospitality. Contrast that to the over-the-top hospitality. These people are cold as ice. Verse 15, they turn aside there in order to stay and lodge it in Gibeah. This is the time where there's no Motel 6 or Holiday Inn. No hotel chains here. No motels here. You either know somebody in a city, you can call a friend or family, that's where you stay, or you basically open yourself up to the kindness of the residents that's there. And in ancient Near Eastern tradition, even the pagans show hospitality. Remember Jesus? He told the Jews about the parable of the good foreigner. That's right, good Samaritan. And we saw what the Samaritan was willing to do. So they stayed in the open square of the city where you couldn't be missed, which meant that it's the setting of the sun. That means people are going now past the city square to their homes. They're sitting there waiting to be invited. And all these people are passing by. Have you felt like that? Just everybody knows you have needs and just people pass you by. It was a complete shutout. The narrator masterfully lets the readers know that there was no difference between pagan city and the city in Israel. This statement would have been shocking to anyone in ancient Near Eastern times, even in modern times. You just don't do that to a fellow Israelite. Rather, after reading the rest of the narrative, the Levite and his entourage would have been better situation, and they would have had better chances at a Jebusite city and the natives of Israel at Gibeah. No one took them into his house to spend the night. That's a commentary of a Jew and fellow Israelite writing about his own countrymen. No one took them into his house to spend the night. That's cold. That is cold. It's like you're sharing your heart out of your great needs. I mean, if you have needs at our church, I guarantee you there's going to be a whole bunch of people and saying, "How can I help you?" Whole bunch of people. Right? When you come to our church and you say, "I'm a Christian and I have these needs," be a whole bunch of people and say, "We want to help." This is the problem with a cold, loveless society. This is a canonization. That's how you know that professing religious people who belong to the covenant God of Israel are acting just like the pagans. Verse 16, then behold, an old man was coming out of the field from his work at evening. Now the man was from the hill country of Ephraim, and he was staying in Gibeah, but the men of the place were Benjaminites. Now here the narrator now brings in a brand new character, an old man. He himself is a resident alien. He's not a Benjaminite. He's not a native. What's he doing there? We don't know. It says he's from the hill country of Ephraim, and he is from a different tribe. If anybody knows what it means to be treated like a stranger, he does, among very cold people. Could have been there many opportunities in Benjamin, so they were there. So the Levite complains that no one would take him into his house. Verse 17, lift up his eyes and saw the traveler in an open square of the city. That's pretty clear. He's got the donkeys all saddled in. They're kind of sitting around looking for people. They stand out like a sore thumb. He said to him, where are you going? Who are you? Where are you going? Where do you come from? We're passing from Bethlehem, Yehuda, to the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, for I am from there. And I went to Bethlehem, Yehuda, but now I'm going to my house, and no man will take me into his house. No man will take me in. A window into the social dysfunction of Israel as a society. Loveless society. Levite's own words indict the social infection of the foundational level. They don't love God. And they don't love their neighbors. The greatest commandments are being ignored. There's no obligation to one another. There's no sense of community. It's every man doing his own thing in his own way without any concern for the need of others. Verse 19. Yet there's both straw and fodder for our donkeys. Notice who's talking. It's the Levite. We got plenty of provisions. He says, also bread and wine for me, your maidservant, and the young man who is with your servants. There's no lack of anything. He says, we're not looking for any handouts. We're not trying to mooch off of anybody. We just need a shelter for the night. Just a little cover. So we can continue to travel tomorrow. The old man said, peace to you. Shalom lecha. Shalom lech. Only let me take care of all your needs. Finally, the only person showing hospitality is an old man who's a stranger, outsider. But he warns here, do not spend the night in the open square. And invites the guests into his home. So this ominous warning would later prove to be of great substance when the fears of the Levite was realized. That the real threat was not from outsiders by pagan Jebusites. The real threat was from insiders, fellow Israelites. That is a sad day when people come to church and encounter Christians and they are the real threat. That's a sad society. It's a sad church. And I think that there is a lot more hostility. Between religious people, it seems. And even among pagans. We need to make sure that that never happens among God's true people. So this is a warning to loveless Israel during this time. Verse 21, so he took him into his house, gave the donkeys fodder, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. Old Ephraimite practices all the protocols of proper hospitality. So far, everything sounds really good. Okay, there was a little minor crisis, but now it's all good. We've seen the setting, the situation, the shutout, and now verses 22 to 28, the sickness. The sickness. While they were celebrating, behold, the men of the city, certain worthless fellows, that's Ben Belial, worthless fellows surrounded the house, pounding the door, and they spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the man who came into your house that we may have relations with him. Notice the male demand that these evil ruffians demand the male, the Levite, to be brought out, which is really interesting. So what happens next is deliberately described in light of Genesis 19. The Hebrew wording is identical. The local hoodlums are described as certain worthless fellows filled with homosexual lust. The details are so strikingly similar. If we're not careful, we would think that this is just a kind of lift off of Genesis 19 and inserted here, but it's not. There are two women in Genesis 19, Lot's two daughters. Lot entertained two supernatural guests, angels. And these angels had the power to blind the evil band of men and to protect the entire family. Here, there was no such power. Verse 23, then the man, owner of the house, went out to them, and he began to chastise them. No, my fellows, Please do not act so wickedly, since this man has come into my house. Do not commit this act of folly. Now notice, he's appealing to common sense in the ancient Near Eastern times. You do not harm someone who's a guest in someone's house. This just goes against everything that they know about their culture. You just don't do that. You don't barge into somebody's house and start violating the family members. You just don't do that. That's something that you just simply don't. You don't enter into a man's house and start insulting him and insulting his family, insulting his kids, and tell him how ugly his wife is and how bratty the kids are. You just don't do that. And it's that kind of horrible thing. Much more that these are homosexually driven, lustful, evil ruffians. Like Lot, the Ephraimite appeals to the men and try to chastise them from their moral evil. Verse 25, but the men would not listen. Look who's talking. Verse 24, here is my virgin daughter. The man is talking to the evil band of ruffians and his concubine. He offers them two women. Please let me bring them out so you may ravish them and do to them whatever you wish, but do not commit such an act of folly against this man. Now we need to look at this in two separate light. Number one, it is a man-centered world, male-dominated world, and women are treated sadly in a poor way. Number two, we need to take a look at this as a responsibility of the head of the household. This old man has invited them as guests. He has every right to protect them. So, the proper thing should have done is that he himself bore all the cost. But he kind of throws in the concubine in there. My virgin daughter and the concubine. What we find next is surprising because, unlike the Genesis account, there's no help. So the context shows that it was the Levite who took the concubine and threw her out into the midst of evil band of men, like piece of meat thrown to wild dogs. Verse 25, it says, and the men would not listen to him, so the man seized his concubine and brought her out to them. And they raped her and abused her all night until morning, and then let her go at the approach of dawn. Instead of going out and facing the men and fighting them to the point of death and even trying to protect everybody and dying with honor, the Levite just throws his concubine out. And the evil mob is pacified by that. We're puzzled to see that the virgin daughter of the man is nowhere to be found, most likely hiding and refusing to go out. And the Levite, in his masculine honor, takes his concubine and forces her out when they wanted him. This poor woman, this concubine, is bargained away by the old man as part of the package deal to pacify this evil mob. He knew something about the character of the men. That's why he said, don't spend a night in the square. And he bargains her. What right does he have to bargain? But he does. She is abandoned by her husband. Her husband sees the whole situation, sizes it up, and saying, this is dangerous. If we're going to take any loss, I can't let myself become the burden for this man who has welcomed us into his home. Instead of doing the heroic thing, he doesn't. He just shoves out his concubine. And then she is abused by a band of evil men. She suffers irreparable damage. Verse 26, and the day began to dawn. The woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house where her master was until full daylight. We have a picture. She is just gasping with breath and just crawling back to try to get back in to the house. The door is closed. She's holding on to the threshold. The concubine's posture shows that she had drugged herself. There. A narrator subtly injects this detail that we saw, her master instead of her husband, points to the highlight that Levite just mistreated her. All of a sudden, her status has just dropped. And we see the callousness of the Levite, verse 28. He said to her, get up, let us go. There's no description of pain or grief. No attempt at comfort, no shock. Get up, let's go. but there was no answer. This description shows that she's died. She's dead. Instead of saying they killed her, the narrator says there was no answer. That's not a good commentary on the Levite. It says, then he placed her on the donkey, the man arose and went to his home. Now, I like the narrator, we need to move on quickly because this situation is so dark and so sordid that it's unimaginable that such thing could happen, but alas, it has. And so we end with this final two verses left, verses 29 to 30, the summons. We saw the setting, the situation, the shutout, the sickness, and finally the summons, verses 29 to 30. When he entered his house, he took a knife and laid hold of his concubine and cut her in 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout the territory of Israel. Now, we're shocked at the brutal, gory detail and don't quite understand what's happening. Instead of getting a decent burial, she gets hacked. And so we need a couple of historical background materials needed here. First, from the ancient Mari tablets, the kingdom of Mari, which was recorded several centuries earlier before the recording of the book of Judges. And in the archaeological find, one of the greatest finds, in a letter by a vassal named Badi Lim to his king Zimri Lim, he writes, "If I had my way, a prisoner in jail should be killed, his body dismembered, and transported to the area between the villages as far as Hudim and Apan, in order that the people would fear and gather quickly to carry out the campaign quickly." It's part of the letter that he wrote. It says, "If I had it my way." The purpose of such action was to mobilize the people, mobilize the troops by creating shock and evoking fear, or whatever that is left to Israel's conscience. That's the conclusion that's also supported internally in Scripture. Now, in light of this archaeological find, 1 Samuel chapter 11 makes much sense. So let's read there. 1 Samuel 11, verses 1 to 11. And the context is Saul is trying to rally the troops. Now, Nahash the Ammonite came up and besieged Yabesh Gilead, and the men of Yabesh said to Nahash, "Make a covenant with us, and we will serve you." But Nahash the Ammonite said to them, "I will make it with you on this condition, that I will gouge out the right eye of every one of you. Thus, I will make it a reproach on all Israel." Boy, that's a tough condition, isn't it? The elders of Yabesh said to him, "Let us alone for 7 days, that we may send messengers throughout the territory of Israel. Then, if there's no one to deliver us, we will come out to you." Wow. Then the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul and spoke these words in the hearing of the people, and all the people lifted up their voices and wept. There's a powerful enemy saying, yeah, we'll accept your terms of surrender. I'm going to gouge out every one of your eyeballs, right eyeball out. That would be a good surrender, isn't it? They said, "Oh my goodness, who are we dealing with here? Give us a week." And then they came to Saul and they wept. Verse 5, "Now behold, Saul was coming from the field behind the oxen and said, 'What's the matter with the people that they weep?' So they related to him the words of the men of Yabesh. And the Spirit of God came upon Saul mightily when he heard these words, and he became very angry." "He took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces and sent them throughout the territory of Israel by the hand of the messenger, saying, 'Whoever does not come out after Saul and after Shmuel, so shall it be done to this oxen.'" You get the picture? This was a call to arms, but also a bold threat, saying, "If you're so cowardly not to come and protect your brethren, you deserve to die like this animal." So here he didn't cut up a human being. So now you get a sense that in the ancient Near Eastern times, they did some drastic things to get people's attention. Now you see what the Levite's doing here. She's doing something drastic, using her dead body and dismemberment as something to provoke Israel to outrage. We say, can such things happen in Israel? The message that goes along with that. And it reached the tribes. Verse 30, all who saw said, nothing like this have ever happened. Seen from the days when the sons of Israel came up from the land of Egypt to this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak up. The end result is that the nation was provoked into action. But the action has led to a civil war. Isn't that interesting that the nation that should have driven out the Canaanites becomes like the Canaanites, and the people that they want to kill are themselves? That's because every man's doing what is right in his own eyes, and they refuse to submit to the lordship of Yahweh. The callous way that men treat women in a male-centric society where the weaker vessels are treated as mere chattel is what the Canaanite society looks like. What we have here is a picture of how far the Israelites have gone into mimic pagan society. Instead of driving out these parasites, the Israelite men of the city of Gibeah had become like them in every possible way, so much so that there would be no noticeable difference in lifestyle, perspective, and attitudes. What are they doing allowing such homosexual ruffians to exist in their midst when the Torah, the law of God, says that they need to be stoned and removed because the parasitic aspect and their infectious aspect will permeate throughout the land? Isn't it amazing how homosexual lifestyle is seen in a very bland or happy or preferential manner in our country? Or murder, like of the innocent, is systematized into law. Or brutality and mistreatment of women, how they're exploited through the media, it's clearly evident. Where we are promoting further and further desensitization of young men that don't really value human life, and they certainly don't value the fair opposite sex. It all stems from the fundamental neglect to care for one's fellow brother. Human life really has become cheap in our culture. The lack of hospitality was simply an indication of self-centered grabbing culture. Levi thought that he had arrived in his fellow countrymen's town for hospitality. But boy, was he wrong. Did he have a rude awakening? Jesus said of the end times in Matthew 24, verse 12, because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. That's what lawlessness does. It brings in continual doubt and suspicion, and evil suspicion at that. And then most people's love will grow cold. And that's why what the law says and what society does in general does impact the individual and the family. That's why laws are so important. Young people look at law and say, well, that's legal, so they think it's okay, when it's totally immoral. And what the grown-ups say, what the policymakers say, is important. So you and I need to set better examples for the young people. Luke 18, verse 8, I will tell you that he will bring about justice for them quickly. However, when the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? What a good question, rhetorical question. The Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? Men are not living by faith, they're living by sight. The end result of such brutal culture is that the weaker members of society is brutalized more. Women are treated with great contempt in a male-centric culture, where men refuse to protect the women, but abuse them. That was the Canaanite culture. Women are not protected, but abused. Sexual promiscuity hurts women and exploits them. Men do not commit marital faithfulness, but insist on dating and abusing women. Unwanted pregnancies abound, with no fathers willing to father the children, forcing the women to abort or fend for themselves. Canaanite society involved at least four heinous crimes: homosexuality, rape, adultery, and murder. All these are rampant in our culture. But the church must be qualitatively different. But we won't be unless we fervently love one another. The problem of Israel's debauchery is they failed at a fundamental level to care for one another. In Genesis chapter 4, they're taught that the first human being that was ever born, Cain, in anger and jealousy, killed his brother Abel and lied to God, saying, I don't know where my brother is. Am I his keeper? Oh, you know exactly where he is, and yes, you are his keeper. I should have taught Israel that you can't say, I'm not responsible. Israel's very survival depended on each man caring for his neighbor. That's why there are so many laws that says, don't covet your neighbor's wife and your neighbor's property. It has to start with the heart. And then it says, love your neighbor. Love the Lord your God with all your being, but also love your neighbor practically. And the practical way to do that is to begin to practice hospitality. It's hard to hate somebody when you care for them. And here is a picture where they don't care for each other. And they are willing to allow atrocities in their midst. So the lesson for Israel and lesson for us is the same. Is that if we allow our life and our church and our Christian culture to be very too individualistic, where we only care about ourselves. And that's the typical attitude of typical churchgoer today, isn't it? What can I get from this church? Instead of saying, God, thank you for saving me by giving me your only begotten Son to die for my sins on the cross and through his glorious resurrection to impute to me his perfect life and righteousness. And then by trusting in him by faith, I have eternal life with you. Lord, thank you. I want to serve you. And since we can't see God, God tells us now, love those whom he has given his Son to redeem. And so instead of thinking, how can I serve God by serving my fellow brothers and sisters, most people come thinking about themselves. And so it's easy to make decisions when it only pertains to yourself. We need to be more concerned. And we need to never let go of the foundational level of love and care for our fellow brothers and sisters in the body of Christ. Because you go out there and it's cold. It's every man for himself. It's every man's doing what is right in his own eyes. And they're justifying their sin, relabeling sin. They're doing horrendous things and calling it choice. What in the world are they choosing? But they're choosing it. Now, if there's no qualitative difference in the body of Christ, then we've become Canaan. But by God's grace, that hasn't happened. Only by God's grace. As we read in Isaiah 1, if God did not leave us survivors, we would be like Sodom and Gomorrah. So brothers and sisters, we're not too far from our society, from Sodom and Gomorrah. As one evangelist said, if God excuses America, he has to apologize to Sodom and Gomorrah. So God will judge. So let us make sure that we are qualitatively different in the way that we practice hospitality, love, and care, and compassion for our fellow brothers and sisters. May the Lord bless you as these things become your life and conviction. Father, thank you for reminding us of the horrors of Israel's sin at a time when every man is doing what is right in their own eyes. And they thwart off your lordship. They act in heinousness. Lord, we know that we're no different. We have the same base human nature. If it were not for the grace of God, we would be like Sodom and Gomorrah. And so we, again, depend upon you and ask that you would continue to have mercy for the sake of Christ, for we bear his name. Lord, let the love of the brethren permeate. Let us continue to fervently love each other, not just in word, but in deed and in action. May we continue to promote and radiate the aroma of Christ. May we begin with the basic foundations of caring for one another, practicing biblical hospitality, and ministering to one another's needs. Thank you, Lord, for your love toward us through Christ. It's in His name we pray. Amen. Lord bless you and keep you. We'll see you the Lord's Day for worship and fellowship once again.